This episode is brought to you by Farm Bureau Financial Services, Zach Miller Agency. If you're looking for an insurance agent with a personal touch, someone willing to have the real conversations about what's important to you, assistance with submitting claims, and offering quality coverage options, Farm Bureau Financial Services, Zach Miller Agency may be the place for you. Whether you need home, auto, farm, commercial, life, or health insurance, we're here for you. Check us out at agentzachmiller.com. Farm Bureau Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Western Agriculture Insurance Company.
My next guest is going for the District 19 seat in Nebraska. Gene, thanks for making time to be here today.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
No problem. I'm Zach Miller with my co-host, Vance Neidig.
Thanks for coming on, Gene.
And we are touching base with Gene Regal today. Let's get a little background on you. Where are you originally from, Gene?
Well, thank you, Zach. I am a small town Nebraska girl, born and raised in Nebraska, but kind of all over Nebraska. My first 12 years were in Osmond. I was in Ashoff. And my father was road construction. So we kids kind of grew up just traveling all around Nebraska. I always say we were gypsies, but just really fell in love with small towns and the culture and the values of the people and what they bring. And I just really believe they're the heart of Nebraska.
That is a good saying there. So where do you reside now then?
So in 76, I moved to Madison. My dad took a job with his brother, and a few years later, fell in love with a farmer cattle feeder southeast of Madison, and so we raised four children, and I decided at that time to work beside him to grow and the operation and to raise our four children, and just never was afraid to wear any hat, you know, whatever needed to be done, whether it was sorting the cattle, vaccinating, loading the cattle, hauling anhydrous, making meals, farming, just whatever was taken. And so really fell in love with agriculture and the ag community.
That's great. That's a kind of a cool story. And you've been married for quite a while, right? You think
42 years 42 to the same years. Man.
Oh my gosh. How do you do it? How do you do it?
You know, it is interesting because anyone who lives and works with their spouse knows it takes a special, different relationship to make that work. And we just figured that out. And along the way, just really became each other's best friend and biggest supporters and just have really been taken back how supportive he's been with my decision to seek this legislative seat.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. What were his thoughts on this whole process?
You know, when I had a couple people who were just really kind of encouraging me to do this. And I thought, oh, you know, I've always been the type of person I wasn't going to expect someone else to do something I wasn't willing to do myself. And so I started looking at it, and I think it came out of conversations that I had about concerns over ag and ag communities getting left behind. And so I mentioned it to my husband, and I kind of expected him to say, hey, you know, Andy and Allison are taking over the business. Now we can travel. We can do the things we wanted to do. Why don't we do that? And he just really blew me away when he just totally took another attitude. And he said, you know, I think you can do this and I'll support you.
That's amazing. Yeah, great supportive unit you got there. That's awesome. Have you previously ran for or served on any other boards, committees, or public office?
I've served on a lot of boards, but, you know, mostly they've been nonprofit organizations, you know, through the years, just always, you know, believe in getting involved and being a volunteer. But the only actual elected one, which I was actually appointed to, was the Board of Governors for Northeast Community College. And so serving on the community college board, I just got a close-up look at the value of community colleges. And Northeast Nebraska is such a treasure for this area. You know, I knew that, but, you know, when you serve on the board, you really find out, you know, what it's doing to develop a qualified and adequate workforce. And they're keeping these kids in this region, and that's just huge for, you know, retaining populations so that, you know, we don't go by the wayside too.
Do you think a lot of that was their focus on the different focuses, they like the utility line and the nursing program and things like that? Do you think it was the way they focused the their?
Well, they're just very focused on workforce, and they have so many varied programs for whatever people are interested in. And they take traditional and non-traditional students, and they're really focusing on making sure that it's always affordable. And that's what I really appreciated. I kind of was first introduced to the community college probably 20 years ago. I went and talked to, then it was Dr. Chips, and was really telling him that we were really struggling to find workforce, and they were coming and they weren't qualified. And so we were spending time training them, and then they were figuring out, you know, there might be other things to do where you don't have to work on Sundays and Christmas.
You have to work when the weather's
shitty. Blizzards. Yeah, exactly. And so we just started talking about different, you know, things that we could do to address that. And I was just really impressed they listened. And so that led to them asking me to serve on their foundation board. And I did that for a number of years. And then one day, Dr. Chips and a couple other staff members came out to the feed yard and said, we've got an ask. And I just, you know, had no idea what they were, you know, why they were there. And so they asked me to be a co-chair for an ag and water capital campaign for a new ag campus. I couldn't believe it, you know, just absolutely did not see that coming and was blown away that they'd have that kind of faith in me. But like I said, I'm always up for a challenge. And so just decided, you know, I guess that's what I'm supposed to be doing here. So we devoted, you know, about a year and a half. It was going to be longer, but then that darn COVID hit. Yeah. Yep. And that really put a damper on things. But we still were very successful. And I don't know if you've been out there, but
I have not. Oh, yet, no.
It's wonderful. You need to go see the improvements out there, and they're not done yet. It's just been such a great asset to the community. But you're right. Their lineman program is statewide known, you know, for what they're doing. And the nursing program is just really, you know, adding to the healthcare professionals in the area. So, you know, I just can't say enough about them. But that, in addition to, a little over a year ago, Governor Pillen asked me to serve on a livestock roundtable. And so sitting around with livestock producers all over the state, we were talking about, you know, what are the big things that, you know, is hurting and challenges they're facing livestock producers. And so we started, you know, looking at the similarities, and it all kept coming back to we're losing our rural communities. And we don't have adequate work housing, and you know, population isn't there for adequate workforce, and we just don't know what we're going to do to be able to survive out here. And so that just made me start making some phone calls to some people about some ideas I had to address that, and it just wasn't getting anywhere. And so one day I just said, you know, maybe I'm supposed to be doing something here. And so started having some conversations, and here I am.
That's great. That's great. It kind of fell together for you. How hard was it for you to resign from your position at the Board of Governors for Northeast?
It was so difficult, and it continues to be difficult. I know when those meetings are, and I just get so sad when I know the meeting's going on and I'm not there. But they are so good to me, and they continually to invite me to things. Like I went to the groundbreaking for the iHub just a few days ago, and got to see everybody and kind of catch up. And so they keep me in the loop, and they're great supporters, and just have such admiration for them. But it was, I felt in Northeast best interest that I do it that way, so that because I was up for election, they could put somebody in place, their choice, you know, and then, you know, she or he could run as an incumbent. So I do not regret that decision, although I miss him a lot.
I'm sure it was a tough thing to do. So outside of what you've kind of already stated, what kind of prompted you to run for office? Is there anything else outside of what you've already talked about? Or kind of just those topics probably?
You know, it sounds weird, but I just really had this inner voice telling me I needed to go do this. And I've always listened to that inner voice, and it's always served me well. So
that's good.
Yeah,
that's good.
We kind of talk about it a lot on our podcasts, the two that we do. You can't really bitch about anything if you're not going to stand up and do something about it. Whether you're successful or not, you got to get out there and do it.
Yeah,
so.
I agree totally. And I admire anybody who steps into this ring because it's a sacrifice. And, you know, you become a target.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't know. Anytime something matters to me, I'm willing to fight for it.
Definitely a time commitment, too. I'm sure you did the forum last night. Now you're on here. You've probably done multitude of interviews.
Yeah. Lots of interviews, lots of surveys. Oh, my gosh. I get a request for a survey 2 a day, I think.
Really?
Yeah, it's amazing.
Oh, interesting. What are some highlights about District 19 and Nebraska that stand out to you?
I just think District 19 defines Nebraska nice. Just really, really good people. Just the kind of people who use their turn signals that show up for funerals. And anytime you have any kind of fundraiser, especially if somebody, you know, is trying to raise money for health reasons, they show up. And I just, you know, I admire Norfolk and what they've done and how they've progressed. But I don't think it's fair to classify the other communities as bedroom communities. I think they want to have economic growth, and they want to have, you know, their own churches and schools and, you know, their own identity. And so I just think it's time that there's a focus on the communities under 10,000.
I could agree with that. How do you feel that we can put more of a focus on those communities?
Well, my observation, you know, with Madison is that we have to rely on volunteers to write grants, know about grants, know about opportunities, and volunteers are great, but they have limited time and they have limited experience. And a lot of the grants that I'm aware of for economic development require people to have expertise in construction and finance and development. And that's not always possible in these smaller communities, especially the villages. And so I really feel that there has to be a way to work with these communities to bring them staff that is dedicated to them. We've got, you know, Norfolk Area Economic Development, and they do a great job, but I just think they don't focus on the smaller communities. And if you have a dedicated person who's always, you know, fighting for your community, it makes a difference. We had an economic development person for a short time, and I saw what he was able to accomplish in those few years. But we lost the funding, and it just kind of, you know, never came back. So that would be a real priority of mine, is to try and figure out funding so that these communities, whether they have one staff person who's dedicated to them or they do something similar to, I've been spending a lot of time going to city council meetings through the different towns, you know, throughout the district, they share a lawyer. So they share legal counsel. It might be possible to do something like that, you know, where you bring in a staff dedicated economic development that is shared by two or three communities. You know, I could see that kind of partnership happening.
That's what I was going to say. That might be a good way to kind of meet in the middle.
Absolutely. Yeah. I just think, you know, that it's time that we have to do this, not just for the community, but for all of the businesses that, you know, are supported by the community.
Right. Because it's obvious Norfolk's getting a lot of grants, and it's obvious they have a grant writer.
Right. Yeah. Right. They do a great job, and it shows Norfolk's doing well. But I'd really like to see a focus on the smaller communities.
I would
also.
Too. And it definitely comes down to having that. I mean, I do think it's kind of It just kind of sucks that you have to have a grant writer to get.
It really is, but that's where we're at.
Like a whole position is made up to just go find money.
Yeah, and the funding is very competitive. You know?
Seems like a good way to waste money.
And lots of times you find out about grants when, you know, you got like a week left till the deadline, and that just is not helpful.
No, it's not. But I do like that idea, though, having some of the smaller communities be able to have somebody to do that for them. That'd be great. That's a great idea.
But don't get me wrong. I feel when Norfolk's doing well, you know, it elevates the area. You know, it brings a lot of opportunity. But I think we can do more.
Yeah,
I agree with you. What do you feel that Nebraska as on the state level could improve on? What were you going to fight for on the state level?
Well, on the state level, my biggest thing is property taxes. As a landowner, you know, the last 10 years, we've been struggling with property taxes. And, you know, it's great to see your valuations go up until you get that tax bill. And I feel kind of like in the last year, it's kind of spread to everybody. Everybody who owns a home, you know, now feels the pain of these valuations and these taxes. And so I think that's a lot of the stimulus why we're really seeing property tax come to the forefront, and that there's more and more movement towards figuring out a plan. So I look at what Governor Pillen's trying to get done, and a lot of people are squawking about, oh, it's just a tax shift. Well, I think it's a tax shift back, because it shifted first onto property away from sales tax because of the rising valuations. And so his attempt is to shift it back. And then, you know, I think once everybody's mad, then maybe we sit down and have an honest conversation that we have to have comprehensive tax reform. And I just think that that's what we're leading towards.
I've kind of been really big on that. I've just never... nobody really cares until it affects their pocket. And that, like you talk about it, and I've noticed it. It's just now starting to get to the houses. People in town are finally realizing, hey, we're passing all these school bonds, and now I got to pay a lot of money. Well, what about the guy that's got all the land that has nothing to do with the school and is paying all that money? different things like that. and then everybody pays sales tax, every single person. And then people say, well, that means that the landowner isn't, they're still paying sales tax. And they may, if you think that they're so rich, that means they're paying more sales tax. I just have never understood that argument saying, well, that just means the landowner's not paying it. They're still going to pay the sales tax. Right. Like, they're also getting double dinged now. At least we're going to take a little bit off of the property side of it. And then they're going to go buy whatever they're going to buy, and they're going to get hit there. So at least it's getting away. It's starting to get a little more fair. We're trying to find a fair way. Not everything's perfect. Ideally, like you said, the way I look at it is that hopefully everybody can get mad and we don't have to talk about tax reform. We can talk about spending. Maybe we just stop spending money.
that is the elephant in the room. We have got to rein in spending. Yeah. And, you know, everybody wants what they want. But
everybody
just
wants free stuff. Yeah, well, that costs money.
It does. It costs money. And we just... I mentioned earlier the Nebraska Nice, you know, and we want to take care of people, you know, especially if they're hurting or if they're in crisis. But when it becomes a way of life, that's not the, you know, motivation by why we're doing this. And so we have to have parameters, and we have to have limits, and use common sense. I like to say, you know, we have to use common sense to just rein in some of this spending.
I trust people to give charity or do good charity more than I trust the government to give charity. And I've always felt that way. That's the way I look at it.
I agree. And if you allow people to, you know, give, they'll do it. But if they know,
government's
going
to do it anyway.
Exactly.
So.
Or, you know, I also think, you know, what's going on contributes to why try. They're just going to take it away in taxation. And, you know, I think we really have to fight back against that.
Yep. I would definitely agree. What qualities and values make you an effective leader and decision maker?
I have been told that I am a visionary and that I really think outside the box, and I'm always willing to listen to everybody. I don't just listen to my own voice. And I think that's the only way you can be an effective leader and come to the right decision. If you are willing to listen to the opposite side, to all of the, you know, angles and study them. And, you know, sometimes there has to be compromise. You know, maybe you don't get everything. I always say, you know, shoot for the moon. And if you, you know, at least get a little below it, you got higher than if you didn't, you know, aim high.
Right.
So I guess I really believe that a great leader, when you're done, nobody really knows who led. They think they did it together as a team. And right. that's my philosophy.
I like that philosophy. You also said something last night where you would always make sure you knew exactly what was going on before you voted on something, or you would attempt to.
Absolutely.
Get both sides, read both sides, read as much research as you can. I really like that comment.
You know, I've taken a lot of criticism today because I mentioned Senator Conrad, and she's a Democrat, and she's got some liberal views that I don't agree with, but I do admire her, and I'm okay saying that. Because I feel she has that approach, that she listens and she's willing to think, maybe I'm not quite right. Let's sit down and talk about it. She reaches across the aisle before she makes any kind of decision. And she shows up every day of the legislature that I've witnessed having done her homework. And I appreciate that. And I don't understand why some of these bills get to the floor and then all these amendments happen. I just think, you know, why didn't all this these discussions happen in committee? Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was my mindset there. And no, I'm okay with saying that I admire people that have that kind of strategy.
Yeah, that's totally okay. I you always hear the blue no matter who, or red or you're dead. And it's like,
no, I don't agree with that.
It doesn't need to be the case.
You know, we need to be people. We got to quit this labeling and this divisiveness, and I'm all for that.
I completely agree with you. What are your thoughts? This is kind of nice little segue. What are your thoughts on the recent news of Senator Mike McDonnell switching parties?
You know, I guess I feel that he is following his conscience, and I'm okay with that. It like I said, it's unfortunate that we think that you have to wear a label and you have to vote some way because you wear this label. You need to listen. You need to vote your conscience, and people shouldn't beat you up for that.
Completely agree with you. That's we had talked about it on a previous podcast, and I said that, you know, the value, you shouldn't have to lose your values and have to leave a party because of how right. you believe.
Exactly. You know, I agree totally.
Especially when it's just one topic. You know, one topic of the whole thing is what made him switch.
A fairly important one, though.
It's very important
for certain people.
But to kick somebody out of your party for one topic is kind of crazy to me, I think.
Yeah, that's always such an emotional issue, and people just demand that you label yourself. And I really firmly believe that the majority of people probably align closer than they think on the issue. They are as compassionate for the mother as they are for the unborn.
Right. But if you're depending on which side you're on, you have to pick 100% or 100%.
That's what they expect you.
There's no middle way.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
Do you think that the parameters of TIF need looked at from the state level? Do you think that it is too easy to check the boxes off to apply for it?
You know, I have never been involved with a TIF program, but I've been reading a lot about it. And to me, it seems like it's a great tool, you know, to promote workforce housing development. I guess what happens is that it gets abused. But I kind of understand why it gets abused, because we as landowners and you know, trying to raise cattle, it seems like if you don't keep growing, you're going to go behind. And so you have to keep borrowing money, and you have to have a close relationship with your banker. Well, more and more, they want less and less risk. And so you are expected to have more and more collateral for any kind of, you know, lending that you do. And so I think that is the issue that city councils are coming up against, that they know that they've done their research, that some whatever development is, that if you spend a dollar, it's going to bring back, you know, X amount of dollars in economic development. But the cost of it requires the builder to have so much equity that they just, you know, can't find lenders that are willing to do that. And so they, you know, use TIF to reduce the costs, you know, to make it more affordable, you know, and less that you have to borrow. So I understand both sides of it. And I see, you know, how it can get abused. But I do think that there is caps somewhat, you know, as far as percentages. And so I don't know if it's as big a problem as people like to think it is. To me, from what I've seen, it's been effective.
I think it's effective as well. Our only issue that we ever came up with was that if we're going to go and check a few boxes on a property that may not need to be blighted at the time.
Right.
That's really our...
That's where I get really frustrated.
Yeah, or farmland or agriculture land.
A good productive crop land for some sort of building that we're going to annex into a town.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see, you know, that would be the frustration of it being abused.
Yep. And then I think a lot of that just hearing blighted is super frustrating. And then we've kind of, some of the conversations we've had on our other podcasts, like they can take a picture, by state standards, you can take a picture of like a tumbleweed going across a piece of land that looks desolate. And then it's, all you got to see is one picture and you can blight it based off that one picture.
Really?
You can make something look rough. That's
blighted
not really
area
rough.
Shall mean an area defined and generally refers to an area with high unemployment. The average age of buildings and structures is over 40 years. Majority of the land is unimproved or lower than city average per capita income, and the area has had either stable or decreasing population. So there's a lot of places that could fit that box. I guess that's that was always our argument. I know it's not something that might not, I just something we wanted to bring up.
Might be something that they could tighten up the definitions a little bit to make it serve more for what its purpose was intended for.
Correct. Yep. That's kind of what we're getting at, is just kind of maybe take a relook at it and
make
from it, the state side of it, because everybody's going, all the cities and everything go based off of what the state standard is. And then they can choose to approve it or deny based on that standard.
A lot of the interviews we've done, they said, well, it checks the boxes, and then we got to make a decision on do we accept it or not type of thing, you know? And I get why the state probably made it a little looser.
I could see that.
To leave it up to the cities, maybe. But still, I don't know. Sometimes it gets abused in the cities, in my opinion. But it's still a good thing.
It's definitely a hot button issue.
Yeah.
It is a hot button issue. And so I'm sure, you know, that is something that they weigh about, you know, if we do this, this is what's going to happen. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure all the options get weighed, and I'm not smart enough to know whether we need to look at it or not. Speaking about property taxes, we've been discussing a little bit with the city interviews that we've been doing about the Epic option. Do you know much about the Epic option at all?
You know, I do. I have had several people explain it to me, and they're very passionate about it. And I applaud that. You know, anybody who takes the time to, you know, learn about an issue, especially when they think, you know, this really is the answer, and that they're willing to do the amount of work that they've done to promote it. I just think, you know, that needs to be applauded. When I talked about comprehensive tax reform, I really feel that the Epic option needs to be at the table. It needs to be a voice, because it has some parts to it that I think, you know, we really need to look at. But as written, I don't think it probably is sustainable. But as you know, I've witnessed very few things get to the floor that go in as written. So,
yeah. What are some of the cons that you see in it?
Well, I think that it seems to me that it relies on the assumption that people are going to continue their spending habits the way they are, and I just don't think they will. You know, that if it's going to be taxed on a new house instead of, you know, buying, you know, a formerly owned house, probably less houses are going to get built. And I think it also will lead to border bleed, that if you can go to Iowa and not pay sales tax on a tractor, but you're going to have to pay sales tax in Nebraska, I can see people going across the border to buy to buy equipment, tractors, whatever. So those are the kind of things that, you know, it almost seems like it would have to be a region to do it. But then somebody's always going to be on the border. So I just don't know. I think there's just a lot of unintended things that we need to think about.
I feel like, I think I get the concept of border bleed, but I mean, you got that on everything, on every topic, no matter what there is. And there's always somebody close to a border, but I think a lot of people, if you start seeing benefits, yeah, you're going to pay a little bit more sales tax here, but I don't have my corporate tax. I don't have my inheritance tax. I don't have my income tax. Maybe I'm going to be okay spending that one-time purchase, giving that little bit of extra tax here, keeping it locally, helping out your local community. I look at it as I have faith in the people to realize, hey, I got more money in my pocket right now than I did in the previous years. But like I said, I don't think it's perfect, but, and like you said the same thing, really, it's not, maybe not perfect, but it's a start and it's good to see.
What I'd like to see is to actually look at a family with a certain income and what they paid in taxes, you know, all of the taxes versus what they would pay if they switched to the consumption, and really study, you know, what is the difference? You know, how does it come out? How does it translate? Do we still get all of our government funding paid for, but yet we give relief to, you know, the families?
So yeah. They do have on this website, they do have a little bit of, they have a calculator here to help you. I don't know that I'd have to do the math myself to make sure it's perfect, but
yeah, we won't do it
property
today,
tax, income tax, personal property, sales tax, and then your vehicle tax, and then it'll kind of tell you what your Epic tax would be based on all that. So it's an option. I don't know. I'd have to go through and do the math completely.
Yeah, yeah, I haven't
just to
really
make sure their math's right. But
yeah, exactly. But no, I definitely think, you know, anytime somebody's taken that much time to do something, it needs to be looked at.
Definitely. We're actually going to be bringing on one of the guys hopefully soon that was one of the writers of the whole thing. So give us a little more explanation on it, I guess.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah. I would like to discuss a few resolutions and bills that have been through the legislature in the past year or that will be coming up when you, if you are to win the seat. What are your thoughts on legislative resolution 22CA that would extend term limits from 2 to 3?
That's another hot button topic.
Yep.
You know, I've talked with several people and I understand, you know, how the discussion started. First off, I totally believe in term limits. I wish we could get them in the U.S. Senate and Congress. I think that would be a way to start solving a lot of the problems going on down there.
You're not wrong there.
Yeah. You know, for instance, I think they said that there'll be 15 new freshman senators coming in. And so this constant turnover, you know, of new senators, you know, that they constantly are having to retrain and get up to speed. And you've got freshman senators who are leading committees, you know, that don't have a lot of experience, I think is the stimulus behind, you know, this mindset. So I don't know. I guess I don't see 3 as really defeating everything that was accomplished by, you know, inserting term limits. But I just don't think that'll ever get changed because it is such a hot button item that people just, you know, are glad term limits are in there and they just aren't willing to risk that, well, if you ask for 3, you might ask for 4, you know, that kind of mindset.
That's what I was going to say. If, it, you know, we get to the 3, then it goes to 5 or 6.
Yeah.
There's got to be a happy medium somewhere. And I get what you're saying because, you know, we talked about it even on the city council where it takes 2 years for them to completely understand. And now we're talking at the state level and they're getting, you know, bills that are.
Right.
How thick. And
so, you know, your second term, you feel like you really know what's going on. And then those years go really fast and you're out of there. Plus those wheels turn pretty slow.
Me personally, I don't see a problem with that because I want a right. very inept
Absolutely.
Government. That's what
they,
I want.
They need to fully,
I want them slow.
Fully bet it.
I want them as slow as they can possibly be.
I agree.
But that's my personal opinion.
Right.
I've made it pretty known on most podcasts that I'm not a big government guy.
I agree. Government overreach has been one of the things that really kind of got me doing this, because I see, you know, we as ag producers, they just regulate us every time we turn around.
Yeah. And beyond just the ag side, it's on the ag side, and it's on every other side too. I mean, I'm sure it is. Where we go on that. But yeah, obviously from the ag side, you and I have seen it. It's a lot.
It really is. And that, you know, is a real concern of mine, is this divide where the people who are regulating us really don't understand agriculture.
Yep.
It used to be everybody had a grandpa, you know, an uncle, somebody, you know, who's on the farm, and you know, had some exposure to it. And that's just less and less, you know, the norm. And so, you know, I just kind of feel like ag producers are getting vilified, and they don't deserve it. We've also always been mindful of the land conservation, and I think we need to be applauded. Years ago, my husband and I took a trip to Antigua. Would highly recommend it, one of my favorite trips. But anyway, I was just really intrigued. You know how in our country it seems like the upper class, the highest, you know, who we admire or strive, you know, or think, you know, are our peer, you know, highest peers are lawyers and doctors, you know, and those professionals. Well, Antigua, it is the farmers. They absolutely get, you know, why they survive over there, how, you know, important agriculture is. And I just really appreciated that.
I've always wondered that here too, you know, and I get the doctors, lawyers type of thing, but then it comes down to, you know, farmers, teachers, you know, things that keep the society really
absolutely
moving is what I've always wondered that too. But I completely understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on the winner take all bill? They were just kind of talking about it a couple of days ago, and I think it kind of got tabled till next, almost sounded like next year. Any ideas on that? Any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I really kind of sided with Governor Pillen and thought, you know, that it should be all of the electoral votes go, you know, to the majority. But I had some lady come up and said, no, it needs to be according to the will of the people and, you know, how they voted. And so I guess I'm a little torn on it.
It's a tough one after reading some of the comments, too. I didn't know where I completely stood. What are your thoughts?
I don't know. I look at it a couple different ways. There's only two states in the union that do it that way, us and Maine. I think it does protect the lower populations a little bit. It does protect us in the second district and the third district. Just cause we'll be honest, the first district votes one way and everybody else votes the other way. So if that first district ended up getting too big, then I could see, you know, a winner take all, you could flip just by people based, which would be a lot less of the land. You know what I mean? Like most of the people wouldn't be a smaller part of the land, and most of the income or the property value and all that stuff would be from the smaller majority of the people paying most of the taxes, especially in our tax base, our property tax value system right now. So
there again, I think we need to address the population migration to, you know, one area. We need to keep people all over the state.
Right. Any thoughts on how to do that?
Economic development.
There you go.
Seems to be a pattern.
Right. The next one I kind of wanted to talk about is Legislative Bill 575. It's the Sports and Spaces Act. Do you have any, do you want to comment on this one? If you don't want to, that's fine.
I'm comfortable commenting on it. As a mother, grandmother, I absolutely believe that biological males should compete with biological males, and biological males should not be in girls' locker rooms and bathrooms. I just don't see that as anything but common sense thinking.
We completely agree with you. I was kind of surprised this one got tabled as well. Nothing got done on it. There were some arguments we had read a little bit on it, and I still don't see where any of them are coming from. But I agree with you.
Yeah, it is kind of a puzzle.
It's definitely that was another hot button one. That's why we brought that one up.
Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
putting you through the ringer here.
Putting you through the ringer here, yeah.
It's fine. I've been totally open with my views on it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm
very people know against.
How our feelings on it.
Yeah. Very against it. And it's not about the way I look at it is like everybody thinks we're attacking. If you're for something like this, you're attacking the transgender community. You're not. You're trying to protect the wolf that comes in, like the wolf in the hen house, like that analogy. There's always going to be somebody. So you got to look at the worst possible outcome and try to eliminate that worst possible outcome. So what's the safest way to do that? Well, let's just not let some man decide to go play women's sports just because he says he feels like a woman and can brutally hurt a woman. I mean, it's happened in multiple sports where there's been men go into a women's sport and it massively hurt somebody. So,
well, I look at it and I always try to think what's the end goal here. And so if, you know, someone, and, you know, I understand, you know, if someone is dealing with gender dysphoria, that's a real thing to them, but they could still play with biological males, but they choose not to because I think they fear getting hurt.
Yeah.
But
so what about the other way?
They feel that creating change, yeah, you know, the needed change is worth risking, you know, women getting hurt. And so they go the other safer route. And so I don't agree with it.
Yep. Respect it.
Yep. Definitely respect it. What is your plan to protect agriculture in Nebraska?
Education, sending representatives down to Lincoln who have more ag background and are willing to educate people down there and advocate strongly for agriculture. You know, ag brings $25 billion annually to the Nebraska economy. We shouldn't have to be fighting for ourselves. It should be a no-brainer. But that's the world we live in right now, and so I'm willing to be one of those strong voices to go down there and, you know, educate people that we know what we're doing. We're willing, you know, to be transparent with what we're doing, but we've made significant investment in precision ag innovations to make sure that we are protecting the ground, you know, crop rotation, testing to make sure that there is no leaching, you know, of nitrates, you know, from irrigation. And actually the new hybrids coming out are using up carbon in the atmosphere. And so we need to be better telling at what our story is and what our accomplishments are. Too often we're just busy, you know, doing our job and thinking, you know, that people understand that ag is important, but we got to quit doing that. We have to start paying attention.
Agreed.
Is it, do we need to somehow protect the smaller to the average to smaller farmer or rancher to keep corporate conglomerations? I'm not talking family corporate that have grown big, but like, let's say just pick a random company owning a business or owning a ranch or owning this type of stuff. Do we need to regulate some of that or protect some of that to keep some of the smaller farms going? Cause, when I was younger, the smaller farm, average farm, medium sized farm, that was the backbone of Nebraska. Now it's shifting a little bit. And that could be partly because the younger kids aren't coming in and the older generations are selling their piece off just because they don't have anybody to take over what they're doing.
From my experience, I believe the bulk of that is the result of government. The government came in and, for instance, you know, with cattle, with livestock, our industry, they came out with, well, you had to do this and do this and do this if you were going to have over 1,000 head. So there was a lot of producers at that point just had to make the decision. Are we going to make the investment to put in the DEQ work, you know, for the lagoons and all of the mandates? Are we going to spend the money? Are we going to do all the paperwork? Are we going to do this? Are we just going to, you know, downsize? And once they decide not to grow anymore, well, there's no room for the sun to come in,
yeah,
you know, and so they can't grow. So, you know, a lot of people like to vilify the larger ones, but they are the ones who decided to take the risk, to decided to stay invested. And if you don't grow, you're going to go backwards. But what I'm seeing now is small producers can't get in because of the exorbitant costs. And so it almost has to be that someone brings them in and says, you know, I'm going to set you up here. And so I am seeing that there are opportunities for young producers to come in and work for farmers and then eventually, you know, possibly buy the ground from them, you know, on contract. And so I'm hopeful that, you know, we're keeping young people, you know, involved. But I just think that too often government has been the catalyst of these things that have had really devastating repercussions on our industry.
Yeah, lots of regulation.
Speaking of regulations, do you feel that some regulations need to be addressed then to help the average farmer or rancher?
Paperwork. They just want all kinds of, you know, reporting done. And you can't be out there doing your job and doing all this reporting unless you hire more help. And if you hire more help, you know, then you've got less, you know, less disposable income to keep growing your, you know, your business and right. Buying new equipment or whatever. So, yeah, it's kind of a vicious circle. I understand, you know, that there's probably been some bad actors along the way that the whole, you know, industry pays for. But that's you know, the exception, not the norm.
Right, right. There is a big push to improve the broadband connectivity for rural areas. How do you plan to keep that agenda moving forward?
You know, I think that's very key, and I don't see anybody not on board with that. I think that will move forward.
That's good. A big priority for you is less government and fiscal responsibility. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on less government overreach and how we can fix it.
I just think that we need to restore local control. I think people, you know, in your community know what's best for your community. And, you know, you see, for instance, with the post office, you know, all of a sudden we don't have, you know, any local control in the post office. Everything gets sent through Omaha. I don't understand that. I don't understand how we save money when we lose local control. And all of a sudden the postal service slower than ever. So I think we just need to stand up a little more and fight back and say, you know, we know what we're doing out here. We need economic development. We need jobs. We don't need everything going to Lincoln and Omaha. And just fight for rural communities.
Agreed. Where are we missing the mark on fiscal responsibility, and what can we do to fix that part of it?
I just don't think we can be a nanny state. We want, you know, to help everybody, but I don't think it's helping. I think that it is has developed and contributed to a culture that it's just acceptable to take handouts from the government, and we got to get away from that. I just totally believe in being independent and self-reliant. I think we need to build a culture that works towards 100% unemployment. Everybody who's able-bodied should be out there working and contributing to society, not taking from the government. So that's what I would always have in mind as I'm legislating.
Well, I can tell you, but Vance and I both feel the same way on that one.
Just beyond, even beyond the unemployment. So I've always felt that the unemployment numbers are a little tricky because, like right now, our unemployment numbers are fairly low-ish, but it's the buy-in. Like, it's the people that are not actively participating in it, so that number actually is really much higher than it's what it's showing because people are just choosing not to work.
Correct.
So they're not being counted as unemployed people because they're not looking for work. They're just not working.
Right. So, I know. And so
a lot of people don't understand that. They see that number and they don't put two and two together. Two different deals here. There's unemployment. That's people actively pursuing jobs. And then there's a term for it and I can't remember the name of it, but
something about just dropped out,
non-active
something like that.
And that's a high percentage. So that I see that where we have to get that number fixed down to, my beyond the 100% unemployment, I'm more into the 100% workforce buy-in. Everybody of able body needs to at least be attempting to find a job.
I agree totally.
And then we can fight. If we fix that problem first, then we can go back to the unemployment.
Absolutely. And I'm humble enough to know I have no magic, pills to take down there, but I am willing to learn, and I'm willing to take my principles, which are always faith, family, and community down there, and try to do what's best for all Nebraskans.
I did like your comment last night, too, about the stay-at-home mom and the homeschool.
That was always a pet peeve for me when I was, raising our four children, because I felt like I was, running, doing everything to help my husband. Plus, I was going to town and volunteering, but I'd hear, well, she can do that because she doesn't work. Ugh.
I don't think that counts when you raise livestock. I mean, I don't know how many times I was cleaned up, ready to go out on the town in the middle of calving season, and something comes in the barn, you're all cleaned up. Well, guess we're not going out tonight, boys.
Oh, you can be in the car ready here to go someplace, and all of a sudden you got to stop and jump out and be a gate.
It's there. Yep. All of a sudden, my time has changed. Guess we're working all night tonight.
I know all about that.
Yep.
Transparency and accountability are very important. What steps would you take to make sure the public is informed?
In what area do you think that they're not informed?
We see this podcast as a way to maybe inform the voters. What are your thoughts on that? What do you feel?
I think, I'll just use like an example. We're trying to go through and look at these bills, and we're searching them, and it's hard to find exactly what's happening, where it's going, without reading the whole thing. If you watch it, it's easy. If you see the transcript and everything, you kind of understand what's going on, but you got to learn how to find it and know where to look for stuff like that, about what's going on, what's getting passed, what's getting vetoed. And if it doesn't make this news, and then part of it is the news chooses to talk about certain, depending on your news, you're talking about certain things. I don't think we're getting the wool pulled over eyes by any of our elected representatives here in Nebraska, but we've talked about a lot is personal responsibility. We take our time to go look at stuff, and a lot of people choose not to because you don't have the time. Everybody's so busy. And if it's not within a 10-second, 15-second clip, people have a hard time paying attention and looking at it. So I do look at it as I don't think we have an informed public, but I'm not blaming our elected people on that 100%. I'm also blaming our public on that. Like, how do we get buy-in from the public to become informed? And that's kind of why we started this podcast, and that's why we're trying to do this.
It is a difficult thing. I remember my years being on the chamber, Madison Area Chamber of Commerce, and we'd have events, and, whoa, we didn't know about it. Well, how much more advertising can we do, So, it is kind of a difficult situation. But from what I've witnessed, people show up at those committee meetings and they share, via Facebook or whatever, what's going on. And then they rile people up, to pay attention. So, I guess I don't see it as a big issue.
That's good. We don't always see it as a big issue either. We just feel it's important to always keep it transparent.
Oh, it's absolutely important. But from what I see, I do feel that the state representatives take it as an important thing.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I guess maybe I need to do some more research too. When we're not in district night, you're looking at other districts and things, and you're trying to see what's going through at the state legislature side. It's kind of hard, like you said, it's kind of hard to find exactly what's being discussed. Right. And I guess maybe that's something we could do a better job at, but
the question is, I think it's not about the representative. I don't think it's about the representative. I look at it as the public doesn't go out of the, a majority of the public does not go out of their way to become informed. Right. I'd say less than 10% of the public is informed. The 10% of the public goes to these meetings, goes to the forums and this type of stuff, 5 to 10%. And then another 10 to 15% sees what they share or post and then gets a snippet, a small snippet, and that creates a cascading effect for a little bit. But then there's 50% of the people that have no idea what's going on. And that's kind of where I get at it. There's a group of people that make a fuss about certain things that have no idea what they're going off of one small little snippet of something. That's kind of where we get at. How do we change that in the public to buy in, to want to be there, to want to be informed? But that's a cultural issue I look at.
And I see what you're saying, because, you know, I've been guilty about that. You know, we've been building our agriculture business, you know, out there, our cattle feeding business. And so I've been very trusting that people had my back, you know, in Lincoln. But from what I've seen just, you know, in the little over a year that I've been in, that's kind of changed. You know, the Patriots group in town here, and more people showing up for the GOP Republican meetings, you know, the Madison County and the Pierce County. People are just really starting to pay attention and get involved. And so I guess I'm encouraged.
We are too, definitely. Even after seeing the forum last night, mm-hmm. how many years?
Oh, yeah. They
were turning people away. Yeah.
Right.
It was kind of crazy. So that was kind of all the questions that we personally had that we were going to go through. We do have one listener question that got sent to us, if you're okay with answering that one. The person asked, what are your thoughts on LB 66? Now, this is would outline the provisions for registering all-terrain vehicles and utility terrain vehicles. Basically, Nebraskans would be permitted to drive registered ATVs and UTVs on county roads. And it would allow counties and municipalities to pass an ordinance granting street use of these vehicles in their respective jurisdictions, and these vehicles would be prohibited from driving on any interstate, expressway, freeway, or state highways. And they would also require the use of a helmet or seatbelt.
You know, we have a cabin just a mile outside of Deadwood, and so we spend a lot of time up there. We just really enjoy that area. And you're going to see all terrain vehicles on all of the roads all year long. And they are treated just like vehicles. And it works. People get very annoyed, you know, when you've got 6-7 cars, you know, piled up. But those vehicles pull off and they let, you know, the cars go by. And so, I would not be opposed to that. I can see that, you know, it's something that we probably should allow.
That's one of those things, as long as it's used in the correct way, you
exactly.
know, people don't abuse it.
Right. And they've got their rules, you know, you've got to have a rear view mirror and you have to have some kind of flag and you've got to have a horn, you know, you definitely got to be licensed.
Right. I don't see anything wrong with it either. I think it'd be a good thing. What are your thoughts, Vance?
I already thought they were allowed on county roads. For farming use, we're already allowed to.
Yeah, exactly.
You just have to have a flag, and you don't have to be licensed.
Is the questioner against it or for it?
For it.
Okay.
Definitely for it. Yeah, I guess I don't.
I was just understood that the like on the ag use, it was already, as long as you're in daylight and maybe this is. With no, maybe they're not wanting specific daylight, dawn
and
to dusk type of stuff.
And maybe it's more making it a state, across the state rule, because I'm sure Madison has an ordinance where you can
Norfolk does too. Battle Creek does. Uh-huh. I'm sure Madison
does.
So
maybe just conformity?
Just a single entity. Yeah, it could be.
That's probably what we're looking for.
I'd have to look more into it.
If this person asked about it. Interesting. I didn't have enough time to look into it too far.
It's nice. We got one listening.
Yeah, I know, right? The next questions that I'm going to ask you, they're more of the federal level questions, but we ask these to every single person that's been on this podcast.
Right.
Not even just the legislature, but just
not even the candidates
of any kind. We ask these to every person that comes on. How do you feel about where the state of our country is right now? And do you feel that we are being well represented at the federal level?
No, I think that we need change. And I definitely hope that change is coming.
I completely agree with you. Do you feel that the systems that are in place still work in today's time? And the systems I mean by that is the two-party system.
It just really seems pretty divided. Once again, the labeling puts you in a box, and it just seems like nothing's moving in a positive direction, and it is very frustrating. So I understand why there is a rising concern about states banding together to move the needle on some of these issues.
I agree with you on that, and it's, you know, so divided, and the bills at the federal level are getting so many things put in them that there's no way that some of those are getting fully vetted. And just like you talked about at the state level too, but these are astronomically crazy. It's just, but I agree with you. Definitely needs some change. Hopefully we can see that in the future. Where do you see yourself going in the future? Now, obviously you win the seat. You're hopefully going to be there for quite a while. Are you enjoying where you are? Do you see yourself staying in Northeast Nebraska?
Oh, my heart will always be in Northeast Nebraska. Absolutely. This is where my children and grandchildren are, so I will be here. We talk all the time. I mentioned that we have this place in Deadwood, and we have it there because we get a lot of cattle out of the Black Hills area. So, you know, we use it as kind of a base, you know, for my husband to go to cattle sales. But we talk, you know, the older you get, it's hard, these cold winters in Nebraska. It's really hard.
Well, you can't go north. That's even worse.
Exactly.
I'm moving south. I'm not even retired.
That has been mentioned. Why would you stay up there? Why aren't you finding a place in Arizona or Florida? So we tried that. And so I said, well, I'm going to go down there and I'm going to get a VRBO for 2 weeks and just see how it goes. I was so homesick. It was just ridiculous. I couldn't wait to get back. So, no, my heart is here. I believe in the people. I believe in our values. And I definitely want to do everything I can to make sure that we preserve a Nebraska way of life.
Agree with you. We want to give you a couple minutes uninterrupted to give whatever thoughts you want to the listeners as like a closing statement.
Well, thank you. This has been a lot of fun. You guys are fun. Anyway, I guess the only thing that I probably haven't mentioned is that I am a Christian conservative and absolutely pro-life, and I'm pro-Second Amendment, and I'm for supporting our educators, but also protecting parental rights, and I believe in fair taxation, and I believe in preserving our Nebraska way of life, and would love to go to Lincoln and fight for those values.
Well, we really appreciate you making time to be here today and giving us your thoughts.
Thank you, guys. You're the best.
I don't think we're too rough for you.
No, not at all.
Big thanks to my co-host, Vance Neidig. This has been Touching Base with Gene Regal, and we will see you guys next week.